Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you very much for being here on this bright and early Oregon Monday. We have a work session that we're going to be doing for committee measures. Then we have three bills that are scheduled for hearing and possible work sessions. I think we're going to be taking the bills in order as they are presented. At least that's my script at this point. And so with that, we'll go ahead and open up a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1571, dated February 8th, 2017. LC 2740, dated February 23rd, 2017. LC 3147, dated February 14th, 2017. LC 3183, dated February 16th, 2017. LC 3270, dated February 21st, 2017. And lastly, LC 3820, dated February 20th, 2017.
All right. So Senator Thatcher moves for the following measures that she has given to be introduced as committee bills. That's, again, 1571, 2740, 3147, 3183, 3270, and 3820. And I'll just note on 3147, this is being introduced at the request of former Senator Charlie Ringo. And then we're calling that out just because we have not had measures coming in that frequently after we start that are coming from individuals. And so I just wanted to note that for the record. So is there any discussion on
3147 isn't in the additional materials tab online.
It should have been added. It was a little later this morning.
Yep, it's there now. So okay. It wasn't a half hour ago. So,
yeah, electronics sometimes take a little bit even time.
They're supposed to be fast as light. Come on.
Someone just didn't push the button at fast as light. It's Monday. All right. Any other comments or discussion? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. We'll close the work session on the possible introduction of committee measures. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing. The first one will be on Senate Bill 345. And Whitney, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the.
Lou, I'm sorry, you're here. Which bill are you here on?
All three.
All three, okay.
I'll continue. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 345 was brought to us by Senator Frederick. Senate Bill 345 requires funds received in cash from a person in custody be returned in an amount equal to the value of the cash received. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
All right. And before we go, did you want to give testimony on all three, and would you prefer? Yeah, if you'd like to do that now so you can get on to your other stuff, we'll go ahead and open up the public hearings for the purposes of taking additional testimony from Senator Frederick on Senate Bill 352 as well as Senate Bill 642. And we'll hold off on the summaries on those last two. We'll put those on the record after when we bring in the other people for those.
Thank you very much.
Senator?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. I wanted to give a bit of testimony, very brief, because you have some folks who have much more detailed information about these three bills sitting behind me. But there's a basic concept that I'm trying to deal with. It is a situation of credibility and fairness. What these three bills attempt to do is to bring some fairness into the process. Because, frankly, for some of the members of the community that I deal with, there's a sense of being under siege. And it's not just the kind of thing that you hear the headlines about in terms of any sort of use of force, but also sort of a drip of harassment or concerns and not being felt as though they're being treated fairly. The first bill, 345, for instance, deals with credit with debit cards. If you come in with money and you hand that over, you can find yourself being handed a debit card when you leave. But that debit card has fees attached to it. So anytime you use it, you're actually losing more money. which doesn't seem fair. That's one of the concerns that we have. So we have people who come in and they have, you know, say $100 or something. Suddenly they leave and they no longer have $100 because every time they use the debit card after a certain time, they don't have all of that money coming back to them. Lou, so that's one of the concerns.
I don't know if we heard you say put your name on the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Lou Frederick, Senator Lou Frederick, District 22, North and Northeast Portland.
Thank you.
Thank you for helping me with that. The second one is an issue of a consent search. There's a real sense of a power play rather than trying to find out how you can be more effective within the community when you are required, when there's a sense that you cannot say, I don't want to be searched. That is something that I think we need to be dealing specifically with because it is something that comes up on a regular basis when I'm talking with my community, with my constituents. There's a belief that it is used inappropriately and overused to try to intimidate as many people as possible. That is that's one of the things that happens. And then the third one specifically is dealing with citations, and that is a curious thing because that was brought to me by a number of people who are law enforcement officers who felt that they were being told that the way that they were going to be evaluated was not on the quality of what they were doing, but on the number of citations. And if you are evaluated on the number of citations you have, you're going to try to get as many citations no matter how minor they might be. Well, if that's the case, you can have the situation that I ran into where I was on a bright sunny day and I found myself driving along and pulled over by an officer because he saw a what he called a white light, a little broken taillight. It was a perfectly circular hole in my taillight. And he pulled me over to let me know that there was a concern that he had about this white light on a bright, sunny day in my taillight. And I just sort of went, okay, you know, that's fine, but I don't understand why that's a problem for you today. Well, it was a problem mostly because he was trying to make sure that he was at one time trying to he was trying to get as many citations or pullovers as possible so that he could say, I'm doing my job because I'm pulling people over. It was not a safety issue at all. It was just simply in my view, of an attempt to say both he had a certain number of things he had to deal with, and for me it felt like intimidation, quite frankly. It was not a not broken, full broken tail light, something like that I could understand, but this was a nice little circular white light. As I've talked with other professionals about this, they said to me, well, that was probably just an attempt to try to deal with you. I was in a little Saturn car with wearing a suit and tie at the time with a passenger with me. And it was a very strange thing for him to pull me over, but he did. That's not uncommon. I've been pulled over every year since at least once a year since I got to Oregon. Sometimes more, a little less now because I have gray hair. But I was all constantly being pulled over. So these are the kinds of things. Again, it's a sense of fairness. All three are a sense of trying to deal with fairness and a belief that by addressing some of these smaller issues, we can in fact begin to rebuild the credibility that we should have for law enforcement in all communities and in particular with minority communities. Thank you.
All right, and just want to make sure for the record, you got everything that you want to say for all three of the bills, or did you?
That's all. You've got other people who are much more have much more expertise on all of these bills, and you have folks who are going to be concerned about some things appropriately. We just had a conversation just a few minutes ago about the debit cards. Are there banks that do not create fees? As I understand it, there are. But we've got to find them and try to get that kind of a contract with the sheriffs. The consent search issue is something that's probably going to be controversial because it is used as a major part of law enforcement in some places, and we've got to figure out how we deal with that in a way that seems fair to the community, not just arbitrary. And the citations, again, the arbitrary nature of the citations is something that I think we need to deal with. But I think we've got some other folks behind me who will want to speak to those things for and against, but I'd ask you to consider them, all three of them.
All right, thank you. Questions for the senator? Lou, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what I'm going to do is recess the public hearings on Senate Bill 352 as well as Senate Bill 642. We're going to limit the public hearing at this point on Senate Bill 345. I currently have only one individual, Gail Meyer, signed up to give testimony. While she's coming up, is there anyone else who wanted to? Kevin, why don't you go ahead and come on up as well. And besides these two, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 345? Gail, we'll let you start.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Chair Przonski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we would like to offer our support for Senate Bill 345. There are a number of services that are performed for jails these days that have a lot of fees attached to them. There's a lot of fees attached now to phone calls. There's fees attached to posting bail. You have to use a kiosk, which takes 15% of the bail amount. But there's nothing that really impacts the inmate more when they walk out the door than this one right here, getting their cash back in some form where they can access it again for its actual true value. And there has been a longer history to this. In days of old, the sheriffs used to give inmates checks. And they'd step out after being released at 12:02 a.m., and they'd have a check, and they didn't have a checking account anywhere. And so then how could they access their money again? So at first, these debit cards were seen as an improvement on that, but they've proved to be, in time, almost equally as impairing. If you had less than $20, you can't get the money back out of an ATM because usually your lowest denomination of cash withdrawal is a $20 with access. But then also these fees add up. So if you don't completely zero out the debit card within the first 5 days, then it has a monthly fee of $5.95. If you use an ATM, sometimes there's an ATM charge of $2.95. You can have a dollar for just checking the balance on it. Some of these companies actually charge a cancellation fee, so if you do want to zero it out, it's $9.95 for that. So there's a lot of nicks that actually deplete the balance. There has been legal action. J.P. Morgan Chase had a lawsuit over on the East Coast with respect to the Federal Bureau of Prison, just paid $446,000 in arrears to a class action suit for fees. There has been an action filed here locally in Oregon. It's in U.S. District Court here in Oregon. It hasn't proceeded yet to any final resolution, but the arguments are that this is confiscation of property without due process of law. That's just it. It's a taking. It's just a simple taking. This does occur upon arrest, not conviction. So this is someone who's arrested and is now getting out of jail again. So these charges may never be filed. They might be acquitted. They might be dismissed. So this is a penalty imposed upon an arrest, not a conviction itself. So exactly how this will work going forward, I don't know, but it's my sense that without some pressure from this legislative branch, there's going to be... it's going to continue unabated unless the court somehow step in.
All right, thank you.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to speak to Senate Bill 345, to express some concerns and to identify with the issues that Gail just raised. The sheriff's departments themselves are not interested in charging fees. So it is an issue they've been having to navigate with banks over time. And as Gail mentioned, the check issue, which is how sheriffs previously returned cash, ended up being problematic for the reason she mentioned, in addition to lost checks, washed checks, and they had a series of problems. When they returned to checks recently in some jurisdictions, because of some of the issues that you just heard about, the inmates actually complained about it. So it is a difficult issue that sheriffs are trying to navigate. when somebody does, when somebody's booked into jail, they also have the ability to utilize the cash that they have in commissary. So the bill seemed to indicate that the money they come in with should be the money they come out with. But in fact, that could prevent them from utilizing commissary within the facility. So my interest and my commitment would be to come to the table to make sure that we're addressing this issue, because we have no desire for those who are being released from jail to have challenges with regard to getting their full benefit of the money they're entitled to. And the fees that occur at a bank level, I know that many jurisdictions are negotiating with banks to negotiate those away. Going to a cash system has additional complexity and problems associated with that. So we'd prefer for the bill not to move forward at this time, but we are committed to work with this committee and other partners to see if there's a way to address it. It's been one that's just been difficult over the years, but there is no desire to charge fees, and the departments themselves do not charge fees on the way out. It is really the bank charges that end up being problematic. So with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the time on this.
All right, thank you. Questions for before we y'all ask questions, let me just get one clarification. And this is from Gail. In your presentation in the beginning, you said at some point where someone's going to be paying into a kiosk bell or security, you said that it takes 15%. I just want to set the record. It's not the kiosk itself or the operator of the kiosk. It's actually based on an agreement with the county or whoever is running the facility as to taking 15% of whatever's posted. Or are you saying that it's actually another 15% above and beyond what's going in for the company?
Chair Przonski, yes. And again, this is something other than this bill, but as I understand it now, if people go to the jail for the purpose of posting bail, they're supposed to put down 10% of the bail amount. So let's say bail is set at $10,000, they're supposed to put down $8,000. Jails don't want to accept the cash anymore, so they say go use that kiosk right over there. The kiosk vendor will charge what I'm understanding to be 15% of the $1,000 that you put down. So instead of putting down $1,000 cash with a jailer, you'd have to put $1,150 down with the kiosk.
All right.
So there's a lot of vendors that market themselves as available to perform these duties, these functions for jailers, and it's the vendors who are extracting the fees. And I just want to clear something. I posted some articles up on the OLS, and I just want to give a shout out to committee staff because I gave it to them last night at 10 o'clock and it was up this morning by 8, so hooray for them. But in reading this, it's not so much the banks that are the vendors, if I get it right, it's not so much the banks that are the vendors behind these debit cards. It's actually vendors who have agreements with banks to perform these services for jails. It's a triangle.
Okay, so I'll come back to that question. Senator Manning and then Senator Denborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony on both sides of this. I just kind of reflect back a little bit when I was a street cop. When I booked someone in for an offense in the jail, city jail, we did a accountability of all their property to include cash down to the penny. The person that was being charged was there at the count. It signed for it. We put it in a packet. It went into a secure location. When they were released, we did the count again to make sure accuracy. They signed for it, and it went out. There was no exchange or anything of any cash going to change anything around. I know that technology now has put us in another place. I do have a lot of concerns about how we are using or how private vendors are exploiting the criminal justice system, which makes law enforcement look bad. So I wish that we can get away from them altogether if it comes back to necessary. I don't know if you can still do that right now. The old way, sometimes the old way is the best way, is to make sure that you account for all of the property. It goes into a sealed bag, just evidence, and upon release, it's done the same way. That way, there's no harm, no foul, everything is correct. And the chain of custody is never broken, and we don't have this problem. But as long as we have for-profit entities that's involved, the person that least likely, or the person that's more than likely to be at a loss, are people that can that cannot afford to have this happen. So if there is a way to get that for-profit piece out of that, I would like to know if you have some kind of solution or ideas.
Chair Przanski, Senator Manning, I appreciate that perspective, and I think that one of the things I need to look into more was a discussion I had with the sheriffs regarding the use of cash within the system after they're booked, so that they would have access to that. When it's sealed, they have no access, and obviously cash exchanging within a jail environment doesn't occur. So their ability to access their own money within the facility is something that's the challenge there, I think. But I need to check and do some more work on that to see if I can find out where that occurs. Because I was under the impression that the fees that were charged for folks when they bring their debit cards to the bank to get cash was a bank charge issue, that they had in many cases negotiated away fees for a period of time to get people a chance to get their cash. But I can check on that with the committee's permission.
Chair Przanski, if I might, I would like to also submit that it might be really great to have to open up the conversation beyond just the debit cards here. I would love to take a look at also the telephone costs that are occurring, because now there's, instead of the telephoning just being part of the jail function, they're now outsourcing that to a vendor who charges, again, pretty extreme fees for inmates to be able to connect with their loved ones. And that's true in the DOC side as well as the local jail side. So if we could take a look at these vendors and the services they're providing for institutions, I think it would be something well done.
Right. Senator Imbro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question was two parts, and Senator Manning asked the first one, that is, why can't the money, just the cash, be kept in secure location just the same as any valuables that the incarcerated person would have? The other is, you know, my mind was triggered when you mentioned the commissary, you know, I can see that if funds are going to go from those that are seized into a potential commissary account, that kind of complicates things. But I'm curious about the way that the commissary account works upon release. What happens to whatever's left in that account when the inmate exits? Do you know?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dembro, I believe that's a part of this calculation, right? They're entitled to whatever cash they have that's associated with them. So that's part of this calculation. What I'd like to do is, I mean, I need to get some additional information. It's clear to make sure I know what the consistency is around the state in terms of how this is treated, because I think that's really important, and to answer that question more fully.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up, so the assumption is that it, in some places it may be reimbursed in cash, and in others via a debit card of some sort.
Senator Chair Przanski and Senator Dembro, I'm not sure. I believe that a majority of them use debit cards now, but I will do some checking for you.
All right, so let me just come back a couple of things. We will have a little work group. I don't know what we're going to be able to accomplish during the session, but I think it's worth looking at. Sure. I specifically want something to be addressed regarding if it's true that vendors are getting 15% off of the kiosk of someone putting money in to get someone to post bail. I think there's a problem there.
Yeah.
So I want that to be looked at, as to making certain that we're not somehow charging someone above and beyond what is this the amount. The commissary part, Kevin, I understand and I appreciate that. It's, well, I guess while I'm not tracking, if someone is booked in on an initial charge, they're usually not going to be there that long. It's usually through the processing within a couple of days, they get arraigned and all that, and they're going to be out. So I can see where someone's going in to serve a sentence for some length of time where the commissary part comes in. So we may want to kind of just look at that as seeing if there's something different that could be done there. And I'll just throw out as another vendor machine, not saying vendor action, but the Oregon Recycling Centers, they seem to actually have it where when you go there, you throw your self-feed, your bottles and cans in. They give you a receipt. You then go over to their dispersing machine. You stick it under there, and then the change and the dollars and all that come out. So they're able to do small accommodation in the numbers. So I think that's something that the little group should be looking at, maybe checking to see who is that vendor, what that machine is, because it may get to this small budget amounts that you're talking about. So any other comments or questions? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
You bet. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 345 unless someone has walked in that said they didn't realize we've already called everyone up. Not seeing that, we'll close that public hearing. We're going to reopen that we recess Senate Bill 352. And Whitney, why don't you go ahead and give us the oversight on that one?
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 352 was brought to us by Senator Frederick that we heard from earlier. It requires law enforcement to inform a person stopped for a traffic violation or on reasonable suspicion of criminal activity to advise the person of the person's right to refuse a search. There are no amendments, there's no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, and just for the record, the testimony that came in from Senator Frederick earlier on Senate Bill 352 is in fact incorporated into our hearing that we're now proceeding on. We'll first call up Gil Meyer and Kimberly McCullough, our proponents. I have then John Teague and Michael Solagio coming up second. Is there anyone else besides the last two I just called that want to give testimony today? Ladies, whoever would like to start.
I will. Senator Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to submit comments in support of SB 352. What this bill would do is it would require police officers to provide essentially a Miranda-like warning to individuals stopped for traffic violation of their right to refuse a consent to search. The ACLU is concerned that what may often be purportedly consensual searches may in many cases actually be coercive to individuals who either don't understand the implications of consent and their right to refuse a search, or who feel intimidated into consenting. Because there's no judicially defined standard of proof for police officers to initiate a consent search, we're also concerned that consent searches can effectively facilitate racial profiling and other types of profiling and undermine our Fourth Amendment rights, particularly for those affected groups of people. We also have particular concern about coercion in the case of juveniles who are searched. Just to give you a little bit of context for folks who don't know about consent search law, For a regular search, when law enforcement wants to search someone, they generally need probable cause. A lower standard applies for like a stop and frisk, or a Terry stop. But law enforcement can get around those two standards if they ask for consent. They can also even ask for consent retroactively to cure lack of consent when the search was done. Officers are trained to get consent as often as possible because of the fact that then that reduces the requirement for proving probable cause or reasonable suspicion. People don't always understand all of this. It's complex legal things and difficult to understand. They also often don't understand that they can actually give limited consent. So they can say, I consent to this amount of search, but not just a very, very broad search. And people often don't understand that there's no consequence to refusing consent, that they're not going to get in trouble for not consenting. They often think that that's the case. And just for context as well, when courts consider whether or not consent was given, they basically look at the totality of the circumstances. That's what the Supreme Court has required, but that standard has been interpreted many different ways by different state courts, so it kind of varies from place to place of what they actually consider to be important in those totality of the circumstances. So we have studied this case or this issue pretty extensively, and we've found that around the country there are a wide variety of reforms that have been adopted. And, you know, some of those reforms are they apply to all consent searches. Some of them just apply to juvenile searches. So based on our analysis, in an ideal world, Oregon would adopt the following set of consent search reforms. And most of these come from reforms in Rhode Island. One would be to require officers to have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity prior to requesting a consent search. The other would be what's in this bill, requiring a Miranda-like warning. We'd also actually recommend that that be provided in multilingual materials, because often people don't speak English when they encounter law enforcement. We'd also like to see a categorical exclusion for consent search for juveniles below a certain age. And then also requiring the court to consider relative scientific evidence about determining the validity of consent, and basically having the legislature set some standards for that. The bill before you today, Senate Bill 352, would be a significant step towards that entire consent search policy package. And because of that, we urge your consideration of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we want to thank Senator Fredericks for bringing the bill forward. We do definitely support this bill. In our view, anything that promotes procedural justice is always, in the final analysis, a good thing, regardless of how cumbersome or complicated it might get. Procedural justice is a kind of a new it's an old concept, but it's newly being discussed in the context of criminal justice reform and procedures. Anything that promotes fairness and transparency, and more importantly, in the accused, anything that promotes the perception of fairness and transparency is a good thing. Because when a person has the perception that an officer and the government at large treated them with fairness and with transparency about what they were doing and why they were doing it, and what they were asking them to do and why they were asking them to do it, it allows for legitimation of the outcome. And with the legitimacy of the outcome comes an acceptance of their own share of responsibility for the outcome, which can actually lead to some reflection. So that's all a good thing. These encounters that lead to consent to search occur over a broad spectrum of encounters. Bottom line, though, a law enforcement officer does not need reasonable suspicion to ask for consent to search, and they don't need probable cause. They usually have probable cause or reasonable suspicion for the stop. But once the stop has occurred, they don't need anything else to ask for consent to search. It can just be pure hunch. But it often occurs in the context after they've already had a display of authority. You've stopped you. Could you please give me your ID, your registration, whatever it might be. So it's by and through and after the display of authority that folks understand they have an obligation to comply with that often the consent is requested. It can look like, you don't mind if I look in the back, do you? That sort of stuff. It just doesn't really sound like consent, but it is technically a question. So just simply informing the person they have the right to refuse the search and nothing bad will happen if they do can't be a bad thing. We think it's a good thing. We anticipate that there'll be objections from law enforcement that will sound very, very similar to the objections of law enforcement after the Miranda decision. After the Moran decision came out, there was just a wail of objection that this was cumbersome, that there was going to be problems with language differences, it was going to slow law enforcement down, it was going to break the dynamic between the law enforcement officer and the person who was being questioned. How were they going to be able to confirm that, in fact, they truly did understand their right to remain silent? There's going to be lengthy litigation about all this. We expect we'll hear the same with respect to consent searches. But the Miranda decision kind of flows. I mean, everybody kind of knows now what they have to do. And is there litigation about it? Yes, but there's litigation now with respect to consents. There just is. So we think just being more transparent, more fair, more upfront is a good step towards legitimating the outcome of what occurred.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. I've got a couple, so I'm not seeing anyone else. So my understanding, unless the state police have changed their protocol,
For consent searches, they require written consent where they actually have the individual signing something to document that they have given that that's not just verbal. So I'm wondering if that's another means of dealing with this, if that's still the practice, to just have that uniformly as compared to the flip of giving a the disclaimer that you don't have to.
Chair Barker, did I hear? Chair Przonski.
Just check and see if Jeff's over here, and you never know.
I'm very sorry. Chair Przonski, did I hear you right? Did you say that Oregon State Police was doing that? Is that what you're saying?
They did years ago.
Okay.
They did years ago. I think they still do.
They may. Hats off to them if they do.
Yeah. All right. The other thing is, Kimberly, you talked about other states, and you gave us the thing about Rhode Island. Do you have a list or some type of tabulation that you could provide to the committee so we could just kind of see what else is out there?
Yes, Senator Przonski, members of the committee, I do actually have a chart of different reforms, and I would be happy to provide that.
Okay. And the last thing, in your testimony, presentation, Kimberly, I caught the word scientific, and I didn't tie it together. Could you just go over that again to make sure I thought I heard something? I don't want to misrepresent it.
Yeah, so Senator Przonski, members of the committee, this is from some of the attorneys that advised me. The way that they articulated it was they would like courts to consider relevant scientific research when determining the validity of consent. And I think what they're getting there at there is sort of cognitive science. How do people actually make decisions? When do they feel coerced? Things like that. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
That seems abstract.
Yeah, I can, just because that's something that I'm not personally as familiar with, I can review what they gave me and I can send you
I
a little more detail about
that. Going like, okay, where is this one going to go?
Yeah.
If you can give us a little bit more, because that just seems a little
absolutely.
Bit more than the woo-woo to me.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions or comments for the panel? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so John Teague and Michael Savaggio, why don't you come forward? John, good seeing you.
Thank you, sir.
Did you check to see how our automata did on the recruiting day?
I'm a bit burned by the whole thing lately, including by the coach. Senator Przonski and I are both Texas Aggies.
Yeah.
Probably so.
We talk Texas every once in a while. Yeah, watch it. All right, who'd like to go first?
I'll go first. Thank you very much. Senator Przonski, members of the committee, and Vice Chair Thatcher, my senator. It's good to be before you, regarding Senate Bill 352. I got to tell you, I'm going to appear underwhelming and unprepared.
John, could you put your name on the record?
Yes, sir.
Please?
I'm sorry. John Teague, Chief of Police, City of Kaiser. Thank you. Like I said, I'm going to appear underwhelming and ill-prepared. And the reason why is I didn't come today prepared to argue the merits or lack of merits for whether we should be doing informed consent. I frankly didn't expect to see ACLU and OCDLA up here speaking in favor of this. The reason why is because we've had hard negotiations around House Bill 2002 out of the 2015 session, which you recognize as the profiling bill. Another element of that is a reduction of some PCS charges from felonies to misdemeanors. There are a number of issues that have been negotiated around that, and one of those is regards consent search. I thank Senator Frederick for his interest in fair policing. If you've heard me speak at all, you know I have significant interest in fair policing. There are ways to do that. I'm interested in seeing all of law enforcement conduct fair and impartial policing. One way to do that, and especially productive way to do that, is what Gail Meyer mentioned, procedural justice. I'm going to make a shameless plug for the Center for Policing Excellence at DPSST as one of the fundamental instructions to new police officers. And frankly, it'll take years for this to happen, but as we begin to permeate all of law enforcement with the idea of procedural justice, treat people with dignity and respect, give them a chance to be heard, convey trustworthy motives, and make reasonable, informed, and transparent decisions. I'd hope to steer you away from moving forward with Senate Bill 352 and to seek your endorsement for the Center for Policing Excellence, where you see that happen. If this bill does move forward, then I'll certainly appear before you again to discuss it more broadly. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggi. I'm speaking for the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, representing line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. With regard to Senate Bill 352, the coalition has drastic concerns with the effects of the legislation and must oppose it. Searches based on the consent of the person being searched are a very common tool in a police officer's repertoire, and as such, they have, in fact, resulted in a number of harmful or dangerous individuals, substances, and weapons being taken off the street. In fact, when I went to my client and asked him about this, the first example that was brought up was a consent search that resulted in a an unlicensed firearm being taken off the street directly in front of my office in Old Town Portland. So this is something that hits home a little bit for me and the people that I work with. But in sum, adding an additional technicality to the judicial process will effectively eliminate this tool and creates an opportunity for cases to be overturned regardless of how well officers are actually following the procedures. It creates an incentive for any defendant to claim that they were not properly informed. It creates a drastic precedent that officers are compelled to give warnings to anyone they encounter or interact with, not just those in custody. And in this regard, it differs very, very broadly from Miranda. And those concerns were shared by the U.S. Supreme Court in its opinion in Schneckloth versus Bustamante, where they specifically discussed consent searches and outlined that this was a very, very different situation than in Miranda, when a person is already in custody and being informed of their rights. To put it more simply, it is a really good way to escalate a situation by having an officer whip out a card and say, you have the right to remain silent. And requiring a technicality like that, when an officer doesn't have someone in custody but is having a conversation, is not the type of escalation that we want to be seeing. In that case, the court stipulated that officers were not required to specifically inform an individual of their right of refusal. However, I will put on record that the individual's understanding of their right to refusal, circumstances like their age, various other surrounding circumstances, are to be taken into account by a court to determine whether the search was in fact consensual. So there are tests that courts apply currently to make that determination. The Supreme Court has not indicated that a specific informing of an individual that they have the right to refuse is necessarily a requirement. And the court's reasoning on that was, and I'm going to quote them, under such a test, virtually no statement would be voluntary because very few people give incriminating statements in the absence of official action of some kind. Meaning that if this could be a slippery slope, and that next session we may have a bill that says that the officers are required to ask in a particularly polite manner, for example. There's no circumstance where it's not going to be seen as at least some manner of authoritative coercion by someone who's looking to be able to wiggle out of that consent. So while we understand the intent of the protections, the measure creates the slipperiest of all slopes, whereby legal technicalities will begin accruing prior to an individual being placed in custody. We're very interested in making sure that people are generally informed of their rights. I would be interested in talking more broadly about ways that we can help educate the public, but having officers essentially serve as miniature defense counsels while they're walking a beat is not the way to do that. And so the Coalition of Police and Sheriffs opposes Senate Bill 352 and urges you to do the same.
All right, thank you. Question, Senator Manning first, Senator Thatcher next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Listening, since I've heard both sides, as a former, you know, police officer, street cop, whatever the case may be, I think that the more informed we are, police officers, we have a protect and serve We are paid by the public to perform a duty. The service is very stressful and very dangerous, and I support law enforcement without a doubt. But I also support and understand that we have to make sure that the people that we're serving is okay and comfortable as well. I think that the more our court system is very stressed by a number of things that are going in, and if we show a little bit more professionalism, which we are as police officers or departments are, I don't really see a problem with just saying a few more things. I served 6 years on Eugene Police Commission, and we've had that conversation as well. If you're going to stop someone and, you know, said, hey, do you mind if I take a look at this open space anyway? So it's in plain view. But people tend to respect that a little bit better. So I remember when I was on the police force, I won't say that because that would drop a lot of controversy, warrants and stuff. Things have changed. Anyway, I'm not quite sure that I see a big problem with just saying, you know, a few extra words and stuff. Our officers are very professional. And most of the time, they're not going to run across the hardcore criminal. We do see that. So we want to make sure that we're building with the community. And just a little bit, a statement or something, I don't really see a harm in that. So what I would like to see is that the two parties, Mr. Chair, the two parties can kind of get together and kind of hammer out, you know, what are these little fine-tuned deals, because I think that they can come together and put a bill together that everybody is, amenable to. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Building on that, getting together and building a bill, all that, it sounds like in 2002 from 2015 might be that vehicle, and I heard mention that there were hard negotiations surrounding that. How's that going?
Yeah, so Senator Thatcher and Chair Pozanski, actually it's been very copacetic. There have been hard negotiations, but it's a good work group. You'll see House Bill 2355, I'm sure. On the profiling part of that House bill, I think the verbiage there is written in stone. On the PCS misdemeanor side of that, there's still things that are being discussed. So you asked, how's it going? I would say it's going swimmingly. The conversations are good and they're collegial. I'll respond to Senator Manning, if I might, and just note that, yeah, certainly I agree that rattling off a few more lines isn't that big of a deal in the context of a police officer's day. Our concern, at least as I see it sitting here right now, is having this bright line threshold that the legislation would make a cliff and take out of the purview of the courts. The courts are already dealing with these matters appropriately and professionally, and we just as soon see it stay there.
All right, thank you. Other questions, comments? So, gentlemen, the only thing I was going to ask is just a follow-up, as I asked the first panel, regarding if the state police are, in fact, still using written consent authorization. Any take on that potentially being a means of making it clear that a person actually did give consent by requiring it to be signed off on?
Senator Brzezinski, so the city of Kaiser uses signed consent. Worked in Polk County. Every agency in Polk County uses signed consent. I have no idea what OSP does.
Okay. Michael?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our coalition involves a number of local agencies. We do not represent the state police, but I will make inquiries to our constituent members.
All right. So, John, if I can just come back, based on your experience, since your department does, in fact, require signed consent, have you seen a problem with that? Or what? Let's say, what's the results been? Because it could be positive or negative.
Chair Brzezinski, we've been using signed consent so long, I couldn't tell you what it used to be like. What I can tell you is that when signed consent is not obtained, let's say, for example, a person is in handcuffs and they're belligerent and we want to pull them out of handcuffs to give them signed consent, we document that perhaps by recording or in other methods. And wherever it's a question, it is always a matter for the courts to decide.
Okay. Senator Lithicum.
In terms of that, thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing just to follow up on your question. In terms of that, it's been a long time. Do you know when that was instigated as signed consent became policy at Kaiser?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Lithicum, you know, I simply don't remember. It's been a long time.
Yeah. If I remember, I think the state police started it somewhere in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. Thereabouts, because I'm thinking about when I left the district attorney's office. I don't know if they were doing it then, which would have been very beginning of 95. I believe it was sometime after that. But it's been, from my understanding, still a practice that they still do. And it sounds like other agencies have adopted or are using it on their own. Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, just following up on this, I want to have a better understanding of the signed consent. So does the signed consent inform the person before they sign that they don't have to consent to the search?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Dimbrough, I haven't worked the road in so long, I no longer carry a card with me, and I wish I did. Kaiser has two cards. We have a white card, which is your Miranda admonishment, Fifth Amendment admonishment. We have a pink card, which is the consent search, and it does note on there that you have the right to refuse. Yes. I should also add that it's with fear and trepidation that police officers these days seek consent, and the reason why is because you don't want to lose a case because you failed to get clear consent. So they go to great lengths to document. Part of that documentation is informing people that they have a right to refuse. And again, where it's ambiguous, the courts almost invariably side on the side of the defense, and the courts, I would argue, is still the appropriate place for that to be decided.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where I could say, you know, from my experience, by having in-car video, and some agencies now having body cams, a lot of this is now documented, you know, live as it's happening. And so that could be like another step or another process of how that could be done. But it seems to me that the policy that has been in practice, at least in some agencies and jurisdictions, of having something in writing has made it clearer for the courts to be able to go through that process and determine. And so to me, they kind of, you could have almost like a mix, because I could see with the other argument, well, yeah, they signed it, but they were under duress. Then the court would be able to see, you know, with in-car video, which not all agencies have it, but a number of them do. The body cams, of course, are still something for future, I think, use and discussion based on just the capacity of agencies being able to store all that material and stuff like that. But anyway.
Thank you. Jim, if I could just follow up. I guess I'm still not understanding. If signed consent is something that you're comfortable with, then what's the problem with requesting consent, you know, informing them that they don't have to give their consent if it's oral? I mean, so written is okay, but oral is not okay.
Sir Chair Brzezinski and Senator Dimbrough, again, I didn't come prepared to discuss the merits of this, so I'm speaking off the cuff. And I'll add that Tim Callahan is sitting behind me, Executive Director of the District Attorney Association. He can speak to this rather exhaustively, and perhaps he should. But again, it isn't a matter of rattling off a few more lines for the police officer. My concern is that the legislature establishes a bright line that the courts are already dealing with adequately.
All right.
Mr. Chair, may I address that briefly?
Briefly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our concern is not so much with the suggestion that these conversations happen. I think it's more with the fact that the subsection 5 says that if it doesn't happen, then it's definitely prima facie evidence that the consent was involuntary. So I think that's getting to that line that the chief is speaking to.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 352. I'm going to go ahead and reopen the Senate Bill 642 for additional testimony. And Whitney, why don't you give us the overview on that, please?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 642 was brought to us by Senator Frederick, who we heard from earlier. Senate Bill 642 prohibits an employer of public safety officers from comparing citation numbers issued by public safety officers for the purpose of discipline, investigation, or job performance. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
All right. I have two individuals that are signed up for testimony today, Thomas Mosier and Kevin Campbell. Why don't the two of you come up? While y'all are coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 642? And as I said previously, because we took testimony from Senator Frederick on this at the beginning, that testimony will be incorporated into the rest of the proceeding that we're involved in now on Senate Bill 642. So at this point, Thomas, I think you'll be first up since you're a proponent.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Thomas Mosier, and I'm representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, representing line officers and sheriff's deputies. I'm here today to testify in support of SB 642. First, I want to thank Senator Frederick and Representative Barker for putting forward this important legislation. Citations are an important tool for keeping communities safe. However, issuing citations in and of itself should not be the objective of police work. I don't believe that any of our members took up the uniform because they had a deep desire to hand out tickets. These dutiful men and women want to focus our energy and time on protecting and serving the communities of our state, not forced to look for opportunities to get their citation numbers up. SB 642 helps to ensure that officers can focus their resources on protecting communities and building solid relationships with the people they serve. This bill represents an area where activists and our membership agree we can do something to bridge what has been perceived as a divide between law enforcement and a number of communities. Excuse me. SB 642 addresses a concern outlined in the Campaign Zero policies put forward by public safety reform advocates last year. This bill seeks to decrease the potential for the issuing of citations for reasons beyond protecting the public interest, which undermines community trust in the police. We believe that SB 642 is a good piece of legislation that will help promote positive community relations and allow officers to better focus their resources. We'd ask that we support this bill. We'd ask that you pass.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to oppose Senate Bill 642. It's interesting that actually the two of us absolutely agree on what he just stated in terms of our objective. This bill would prevent a public safety employer from comparing the numbers of citations between officers. Before I speak to the provisions of the bill, I think it's really important that I just say that Oregon sheriffs and police chiefs are committed to enforce the law that the legislature passes and that the governor signs with our shared motivation of public safety. Our policing leaders do not support an enforcement of laws based on quotas or for the purpose of generating revenue, period. That's an across-the-board commitment of our leaders. We believe the appropriate focus of law enforcement efforts should be on keeping or seeking voluntary compliance with the ultimate goal of keeping the public safe. That is the objective. An example of this occurred last week when Superintendent Travis Hampton announced a new car care program. You may have heard about it. It's in partnership with Advanced Auto Parts and CarQuest Auto. As part of the program, OSP troopers offer drivers stop for minor equipment violations with a voucher that assists with the cost of the replacement parts as a way of encouraging folks to actually fix their vehicles and become safe again. A vast majority of these violations are for blinkers, headlights, and taillights. You heard Senator Frederick mention that he's been pulled over for those kind of things. Imagine if he was given a voucher to help with the cost of the actual part. This is what Superintendent Hampton said about this, and I thought this is instructive, and it's reflective of our leaders more and more around the state. Every OSP trooper understands they can influence the trajectory of a person's life, which is why compassion is a core value of the agency. So the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and State Sheriff's Association oppose Senate Bill 642. For the purposes of discipline, investigation, or job performance of an officer's, agencies rely on a wide range of different evaluation tools. Senate Bill 642 identifies one potential way of evaluating performance, and then in statute prohibits agencies from making the type of comparison between officers. We're concerned about any legislation that limits the process of officer evaluation in these situations. Agencies are already constrained by collective bargaining agreements, employment law, and best practice in this area. They're also accountable to city and county governing bodies. With regard to the specific practice identified in Senate Bill 642, we suspect that the focus is on an officer that doesn't give enough citations. However, this law would also prevent agencies from addressing an officer who is aggressively issuing citations or who is issuing citations that are disproportionately issued to persons of color or other impacted minority communities. We believe that agencies right now evaluate their officers on a wide range of things. And certainly, this is just one. And in many cases, it's not used in agencies at all as a comparison. And so our strong preference would be for this bill not to move forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Questions for either Senator Thatcher first?
I saw your face. I guess I want to know what you would have to say to the what was said about it being it would be difficult for an employer to evaluate a person giving out too many tickets or
right.
targeting people of color.
I mean, well, that's not our intent in any way, shape, or form with this bill, and I don't think the bill itself speaks to that in any way. I also. It doesn't preclude inquiries into demographic data and meeting the requirements and the intent of the anti-profiling measures, which are involved in other bills that are coming forward this session. This is merely looking to stop potential gamesmanship of citation collection, basically incentivizing issuing more and more tickets without necessary public safety cause.
One follow-up. You know, I heard you say that it is not the goal to give out as many tickets as you can or to be a source of revenue, but I tell you that is a wide perception out there, and something like this could possibly alleviate some of that.
Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, I mean, I think that the law enforcement profession as a whole, as Chief Teague mentioned earlier, has been in a new trajectory in a number of ways. The procedural justice issue is extremely important, and that's why our training at all levels has changed. You know, officers are now trained to make sure that they are approaching people in a way that increases confidence, because I think public confidence in policing is earned one contact at a time. And I think Superintendent Hampton's program and other cities and counties are pursuing similar programs will have the effect of increasing the public's confidence. I would just say up front that being a part of the two associations, I can say with confidence, our leaders oppose the quotas and the revenue-based ticketing that used to be more a part of policing. And it used to be more a part of policing because local governments saw it as a revenue source, and the state, by the way. Right? We used to increase fine revenues until we were literally taking people's grocery money away. My problem with this bill is that it creates a limitation, again, within the employment environment, and it says you cannot evaluate these things. Some officers are given the responsibility for addressing particularly dangerous areas where violators create a safety risk that could result in somebody's injury or death. And an officer that is just simply not performing should be evaluated. And I just am careful to, or our folks are concerned about kind of a trend of stepping into the employment evaluation. Plus, I don't have an injured party here, so I have a hard time responding. I'm sure there have been agencies that have done this in the past. I just don't know who they are. I think that my feedback from folks that I talked to indicated that when they do evaluate based on citations, it is not for the purpose of evaluating their revenue-generating capacity. So, anyway, hopefully that's helpful. I appreciate the committee's time on this.
Chair, if I may, to that quickly, I can speak. Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, I can speak directly as of right now. When we spoke to our membership, this came up, and we understand that currently West Lynn and up until recently, I believe, Woodburn were using this as a means to evaluate officers. And it had some semblance of seeming to lead to an increase of ticket, the issuing of tickets. And that's where this concern arises from, is that there is a general public perception that there's something that isn't necessarily purely within the interest of increasing public safety involved in that.
Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read this and I look at it, I see it a little bit different, Kevin. I see it in terms of, you're not having this as, I remember when I first moved here, Coburg came out. Don't go down Coburg.
I'm going there.
Oh, no. We've been there.
Yeah, don't do that. And the other day I was going back by and I see Coburg back out on I-5, waiting. I've seen been places where others have been out there. And it is, I don't know for a fact, but you can assume when you have a speed zone that's at 55 and all of a sudden it drops to 35. So there are concerns about the public and stuff. And the way I see this is that it's just saying that if you're going to do a fair evaluation of an officer, you can't discipline one because they didn't get this number of tickets versus that, and there's no comparison. And so I look at it like this, that it's designed to protect the officer. You know, if you're out there, you're doing your job, you don't come up saying that, okay, I got to reach this number or something to get a good evaluation. So I think that this takes the pressure off the individual officer. This is the way I'm looking at this versus a broader hideous thing out there. And I'm not convinced that it's a bad thing.
All right. So Senator Denbrough, then the chair has a couple of comments.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. Thomas, it seems clear that the purpose of this is to prevent officers from being pressured to write too many tickets, right? But it's true that the way it's written, it could also be a disincentive for districts to monitor whether somebody is being overly aggressive, right? Would you be open to language modifications that would prevent that kind of outcome? Because it sounds as if that's not something you're interested in.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Denbrough, it's something I would talk to my membership about, and I believe they'd be open to some modification that would do that. Obviously, the intent of this is to stop the direct officer-to-officer comparisons and things like that.
All right, let me make a couple of comments, not necessarily needing response, but something that this is going to be worked. The other two bills are going to have a little bit more work before we try to see if we're going to actually do work sessions on any of the three. Seems from my perspective, one of the things we may want to look at, it seems like everyone's in agreement, no quotas. So maybe we just need to put something into our statutes as to the enforcement of traffic laws. It's not for the purpose of raising revenue or doing quotas as some type of comparison. I'm not sure if the relating clause will let us get there all the way, but it seems to me maybe a principle of statement that we just put out there that could be kind of the framework would be something that we might want to consider. And just for the record, Coburg was one of those situations where I had state troopers coming to me and telling me what was happening. They were doubling up on I-5. This is a time when they had no jurisdiction over Interstate 5. They now have jurisdiction from their main exit going south to the Reeds or the service exit overpass. And they were bringing in close to $750,000. And that was how they were running their city. They no longer are doing that. They are out there on occasions. I do see them. But I do know that they have a completely different philosophy as to what they're doing and why they're doing it. And as much as it was a rocky road for many of us who were taking the principle that we took, the reality is I think it's better. And it's one of those situations that we should be very aggressive on that type of tools being used, because it really gives law enforcement a very bad name across the state if we allow for just one to do those type of things. Senator Lithicum?
A follow-up, not in response to your comment, I appreciate that, but with regard to the specificity of this wording, it prohibits an employer from comparing. I think in light of public safety officers and the high level of professionalism that we're looking for from those individuals, to have this Katie bar the door single issue is a misstep.
Yeah.
What we really want is employers to have as much information at their fingertips as possible to help determine the appropriateness and professional stature of their force. So I think this is in the wrong direction. If you want to address quotas, let's address quotas.
Yeah. And I think that we'll see through the work group what we can do. This is where you'll more than likely have an opportunity to see where a bill has been introduced with some certain context and framework, but to come back that maybe addresses some of that, but not in the, let's say, in the means that has been brought forward, at least my taking of what I'm feeling and hearing from this panel, or from the committee, I should say. Gentlemen, thank you all
thank
very
you
much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 642. And before I do that, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony? We'll take it on a different day if you do, because I do need to go ahead and close the committee at this point. Not seeing anyone, we are going to go ahead and close the public hearing 642. And that should take care of all of our work for today. Tomorrow, we're scheduled to be here at 8. And we'll see everyone there. Thank you very much. We're adjourned. Hey, Mr. Chair.